The O'Connor community began about 12 years ago, and we've been at O'Connor, my wife and I and our family, for about 11. And the group of us who went to Eastleigh Gospel Chapel in Melbourne, who found an old guest house up in the hills which was derelict and not being lived in and falling down, and we took it over and developed it into a retreat and counselling and teaching centre. We have a static community of about 35 people living around the guest house in our own homes, and some living in the guest house, and then we have folk coming and going all the time for all sorts of reasons. Some are sent because they need counselling, sent by doctors or pastors or social workers, and others come because they just want to retreat and have a holiday. And we have groups that come in as a whole church for special ministry, and we run marriage enrichment weekends and relationship enrichment for courting couples and a whole range of things like that. And out of our residential counselling program, we've now developed 5 counselling centres in the city of Melbourne, and there is somewhere between 60 and 100 folks pass through those centres every week, and they're manned by Christian psychologists, one, and social workers, one who's part-time and the other four, one is full-time and the other four part-time. Someone up the back, I think. I think the real problem is not so much saying no, it's the problem of saying when. I don't think that there's very many times that as counsellors we need to say no. I mean, at some point we ought to be available to help, but I think sometimes we need to be in control of when. And I found that as a pastor, the demands when I was pastoring, the demands came at meal times when I had come to spend time with my family, the phone would ring or someone would call, and I would just go and do the thing rather than saying, this is the hour I spend with my family, or this is my day off, or whatever. Most people can wait till the time you allocate. Now, there might be the odd person who's about to down a bottle of pills, and even then, if you know the person, you might be able to ask them to wait and take the pills in the morning because, you know, they do it regularly. We have a lady up near where we live who quite regularly takes a life, and usually I wait till the next day before I bother to go and see her. And I think that you've got to be able to be in control. I think that's the thing. And if you've got a full program, then they may have to wait a day or two. But most people have had the problem for years, and they've just suddenly decided to look for help, and they can wait another couple of days. I think it's learning that, and I'm still struggling with that, although I think I'm learning some aspects of that now, that I'm able to say, hey, it's all right, I'll get to it when I can. So I don't think it's so much a matter of saying no, it's a matter of saying when I'm able to clock it in and do it reasonably. And don't say when at the cost of yourself or of something other thing that is really valuable. There's a little thing we share in marriage enrichment that I just want to share with you. It's a beautiful principle. It goes, I count and you count. I'm a person of worth because I'm made in the image of God and because I'm indwelt by the Spirit of God, and you're a person of worth by the same criteria. My feelings count, my needs count, my opinions count, your opinions count, your feelings count, your needs count. I will meet your needs to affirm your worth, but not at the cost of my worth as a person. Because once I do that, then I'm not really loving you. When I'm denying or discounting my own worth, then I'm not really loving you. It's only when I'm counting my worth as well that I can really count yours. And I think get that into perspective, and that's a tremendous help in being able to react to those sorts of pressures. It's a very deep issue, and I'm not sure just how I'll be guided by you, how far you want me to go in discussing it, but the first thing that I would say to that, Eric, is that very often the actual act of incest was not necessarily a traumatic, life-wounding thing. It was often even enjoyable. You know, it was often a thing that, if I just finish that and then you come back, it was often something that wasn't necessarily devastating until everybody started getting excited about it and everybody started to, the police got called in, or the man says to the little girl, "Don't you tell anybody," and all these guilts and fears and hostilities are started to be projected on her. Then she embodies all that in her own little childhood mind and then has no way of dealing with it. And as she grows up, they become forces that dominate her. All this guilt that she felt, all this anger that she felt, all this rejection that she felt. You know, this guy really loved her and then suddenly he's not allowed to touch her anymore. You know, there's a whole range of things that can happen.
Yes.
Mm. Yes. That's right. And so what we have to encourage people to deal with is not so much some traumatic thing that happened in terms of dealing with that, but dealing with all their feelings about that, dealing with all that anger and resentment, and very gently we have to help them to understand that they are responsible for what they feel. And to work through that, and look, don't do that lightly. I mean, you know, if I said to you, "Look, your anger's your anger, you deal with it," yeah, that really is a bit intimidating, isn't it? So you have to be very gentle about how you get people to deal with emotions, but they are their emotions, and in the end they've got to deal with them. And I try to draw a line of definition between blame for the act and responsibility for what's happening today. And that's where I work at that level all the time. And rape, of course, is even more traumatic because often there is physical damage and pain and fear and a whole lot of things related to that. But still, in the present, it's still what I choose to feel toward that man or what I choose to feel toward myself, which becomes the debilitating thing. I think it's a little like grief. It's both, you know, it's a process and a state. I think many people minister out of what could well be called a process of going downhill, a process of burning out, and they reach a point where they can't minister anymore, and that is burnout. And the process of burning out is accompanied by a lot of those symptoms that are there a long time before we acknowledge them. Trouble is that the very first ones are not the headaches. The very first ones are signs of short-temperedness, irritability, sometimes even redoubling our workload. I always worry about a man who says, "I'm working harder than ever before and enjoying it more than ever before." I worry about that. I think, wait on. I wonder if everybody else thinks he's enjoying it more. You know, I wonder if his wife is finding he's more tense, more driving, more dominating than he was before. And if that's the case, there are signs of burnout that other people can see, but he can't see. And that's why you need to be surrounded by caring friends when you're in Christian work, who you give permission to tell you when they see the signs of burnout. Who can come to you and say, "Hey, it isn't going quite as well as you think it's going." Because our perspective gets all out of kilter when we're burning out. We see things like they're not. And we see things being better than they are, and things that are going well when they're not going well. And it's important for us to keep buoying ourselves up and say things are going well, when in fact they're not. And we need someone who we love enough and respect enough who can come in and say, "Hey mate, it's not going well. And you need to stop and step back and look at it." I almost need to say I don't think we do cope with that. I think by that time we're on the downward spiral. Unless somebody steps in, helps us see that, we will never really cope with it. I think when someone does step in, we have to break from our work. Once we're at that stage, you need to break away, and even if it means cancelling a mission or cancelling appointments, you've got to do it if you're going to be there in a year's time. I don't think that at that stage we can save ourselves. We need to be saved by someone else once we get there. Guilt is a very... most of us have guilt at some level, sadly enough. But guilt motivates at some level. But once we get to that stage, we're really in bad trouble. I know of a guy in Christian ministry, and he's out today, but he had people doing things for him, colleagues, and before he finally bombed out altogether, he had taken every one of their jobs off them and was doing them himself. Because his perspective was, not doing it properly. You're not doing it properly. And they were doing it okay, but he took it all over and just kept doing more and doing more, and finally he just fell apart. And because he was getting guilty and angry, but he couldn't acknowledge that or see that. Some of the steps that I gave for avoiding burnout would be, some of them, would involve forget what they were. Yeah, rejecting guilt as sort of realizing that I'm being pushed by guilt, accepting responsibility for faithfulness and so on, delegating things around. But one of the very important things is to have a holiday. Now, some of you might be on committees that have responsibility for full-time workers, and I think we ought as committees accept the responsibility of assessing regularly the health of our worker or workers, to the point where instead of being bound to the fact that a preacher gets 4 weeks holiday like everybody else and long service leave after 15 years, we ought to accept the responsibility that that is unrealistic. If a man is moving in that sort of an area of ministry, he needs breaks more often than every 12 months, and he needs long service leave in maybe 5 to 7 years, maybe 5 years. And that long service leave, I think, should, if possible, take the form of some sabbatical, some ability to study or to write or to do something that is different from preaching. But I don't know whether any of you are in those sort of positions where you help look after staff, but I certainly believe that that's where we should be pushing toward. And I'm about to take a sabbatical from counselling for 12 months, because in 10 or 12,000 hours of counselling, I reckon I'm ready for an oil change, and so do others. And my council are taking an initiative in saying, that's it, we want him to do that. So I think that has to be encouraged. Right. Let me draw a line of definition between a line of demarcation between marriage enrichment and marriage counselling. Marriage enrichment, I think, is any sort of there is a program called marriage enrichment run by a movement in Australia called Couples for Marriage Enrichment Australia. Is there anybody here who's a leadership couple for that? You're not, are you, Alan? There are couples who are trained to lead that in every state. Julie and I are one of the couples in Victoria. But anything which works on the growing edges of marriage for couples is marriage enrichment. And the growing edges would be things like conflict resolving, communication, sexuality, priorities, discipline of children, roles in marriage. They're the growing edges, and I think a marriage enrichment program, whether it be rooted in a Sunday morning series or whether it be something that a group of young marrieds do in your church, should all centre around those things. And I think what we've got to assume is the people who come to a marriage enrichment event are people with good marriages who just want to make them better. And people with bad marriages who've already lost the art of communication don't very often benefit out of marriage enrichment. They will may benefit a little, but often don't. And I think for them you need some sort of either group marriage counselling situation or individual marriage counselling situation. I would be glad to talk to any interested later about how to plug into marriage enrichment in your own state a bit. And in Victoria we run, at Alcana we run 7 marriage enrichments a year that run over a weekend. And the two hardest lots of couples to get to a marriage enrichment are brethren and Baptists and full-time workers. Because for some reason or other we've got this awful feeling that you know, somebody's going to discover that we've got a rotten marriage, you know? And we play it so close that I've begged some of my preacher friends to come to marriage enrichment and I can't get them there. And I've got to saying now publicly that everybody who goes to marriage enrichment has got a good marriage, and all my friends are asking, why haven't you that couple come? You know, why doesn't that couple come? You know, there must be something wrong with their marriage. So I'm trying to shame people into it, but still hard to get them there. Harris hasn't been yet. Brethren and full time. Right. Sorry. Did you want to follow that through a bit, or was it a different subject? Right.
With all the pressures of the lot they have, is there really a future for full-time?
Yes, but I think there has to be a greater emphasis on two things. I think there's got to be a greater emphasis on the pastor and his wife being a part of the body and not the performers in the middle of the arena. And to that end, I suggest a very fine little book that you might read called Love, Acceptance and Forgiveness by Jerry Cook, in which Jerry Cook comes to the realization that the church needs to be the force out in the field, not the minister being the force in the field. And it's really worth reading. But the second thing is, I think we've got to do a lot more in terms of moving toward team ministries. We have a little church at Marysville, to which both Ivor and I happen to belong. And it's a very exciting little church, only 3 years old. It's just called the United Church. It's just an indigenous church. And we have no full-time pastor in the church, but we have a number of people who are part-time, partially supported, or not financially supported at all, who've given 2 days or 3 days or whatever a week toward ministry. Now, I can't see any reason why that can't happen where there is a pastor. That a pastor should build around him a team of people. What about all the retired people in our... Some of our best folks at Elkana over the years have been people who have retired early and given 2 years or 3 years to Elkana ministry. And the sad thing about that is that their church didn't grab them first. Why? And I've looked at some of these people, like two couples we've got at the moment, and said, how on earth did your church let you get away? You know, they should have grabbed you as soon as you retired and appointed you as an honorary pastor and built you as a team around the pastor, so he now has a team of 3 or 4. And I think that's where the future is seeing that we're part of a team and begin to play down the one-man ministry issue. And maybe sometimes that pastor will see there are better preachers in his church than him, and he ought to use them to preach while he does other things that he's gifted to do. But I think there'll always be room for the full-time church-employed pastor, but I think he may well play a different role.
I think part of the problem is...
Oh! So
you've got a vital thing there, the senior pastor being willing to shell off some of those tasks.
Yeah.
To others, to see you appoint other staff.
Yeah.
The thing we have trouble with is passing on some of our roles to those who are appointed.
Yes, yes.
And not just for ourselves, it's for our people, accepting that these roles no longer rest with the pastor.
Yeah, right.
But they now rest with other members of the pastoral staff.
Right. So where it happens best is where there's a recognition of gift in the layperson, who's maybe a school teacher, but has got obvious gift, then the church says, we believe this is the man who ought to preach to us. We will call him to be part-time or full-time to exercise his gift of preaching. Another one might have a gift of pastoral ministry, and that you build up your team out of the recognition of gift in the church. Love, acceptance and forgiveness, Jerry Cook. Right. Part of that sabbatical I talked about could well be for the itinerant evangelist to go into pastoral work for 3 months or 6 months or a year. Or it might be for the minister to go back into some sort of secular work for all. I think that's why I suggested a sabbatical, because a change of pace and re-entry into the real world, whatever that might be, is a very important issue, I think, in terms of coping with our mental health. One of our...
The point I'm getting at is not necessarily having a
I'm not sure that there would be any overall answer in terms of time, because every person is different. I would think certainly less than 10 years. That's my experience. I think I'm fairly resilient. I see myself as a fairly strong person, but I would think that by the time I... Because you see, one of the things you've got to realise is that I've been in Elkanah 10 years, but I've been in ministry 25 years. And some of you have been in your role 3 years or 4 years, but it's 18 years since you entered the ministry or whatever. So I would think that once you're up to that first decade of ministry, that's the time to really sit back and see whether you need to move into something else. Now, I realise that's all idealistic. And ministers, the Baptist Church or the Church of Christ or whatever, are probably short of men, and the thought of their men dropping out for a year every 10 years would be, you know, almost an unbearable thought. You know, where do we get ministers? But I think it's worth thinking about to change pace and do different things. Someone else. One of the issues I was going to raise and didn't raise is that right at the moment in Australia we have an increasing number of men in the ministry who are becoming involved with another woman other than their wife, and a lot of fairly dramatic marriage breakdowns as a result of infidelity, or as a result of the wife becoming bitter and resentful about his role. And I guess we're always a little bit afraid to talk about this whole area of sexuality and infidelity and so on at the parsonage level or the evangelistic level. But brothers and sisters, it's there, and it's a big issue. And in the past, we've tended to address it by saying that ladies should counsel ladies and men should counsel men, and we should counsel with a glass door and all those sorts of things. But that's not really the answer to the problem. And the answer to the problem is learning not to, I think, is not to live your lives in isolation. We've got to be able to share our lives and our ministries, ideally with our wives or our spouses. If you happen to be a woman in full-time work, then you ought to be able to share it with your husband. And or a close friend who becomes your prayer partner. I have a colleague that I work with, a psychologist by the name of Ian Murray, and it's just a very important thing for us to, from time to time, sit down with each other and share where we're at, when we're feeling a bit subjective about a situation, or where sometimes you feel a sense of attraction that goes beyond just being concerned for a person. All those sorts of things have to be shared when they become problems. At the immediate time, they become a problem. And I think that's much, much safer than counselling behind a glass door, or counselling with the door open, or just counselling people of your own sex. I think it's important for us to not live our lives in isolation. Are you hearing what I'm saying? One of the big traps in ministry is to think that because you're dealing with confidentialities, that means nobody can know what's going on inside you. That's deadly. Someone's got to know what's going on inside you. They don't necessarily have to know the facts of that person's problem. You're not in a position to share confidentialities. That's important. But it is important that you share with somebody how you're responding to those sorts of situations. And I just want to impress that on you very strongly. Again, I'm seeing this happen in a wide area today in the ministry, that Christians' marriages are breaking down either because the man has got himself trapped, or alternately and more commonly, he has become an isolate. And because he becomes an isolate from his wife, she can't reach him anymore, and so the communication breaks down and the thing finally just falls around him. So my encouragement to you, that's an area I didn't touch on very much in the session, but I really want to encourage you here in this session. Get a friend. If you share with your wife or your spouse, that's important. But I think it's also important for you guys to have a close male friend who becomes your spiritual director or your confidant, that you share with. Not share things that you don't share with your wives, so I don't think that's a good idea, but share with anyway, so that someone else knows where you're at, can pray with you every week and encourage you, and you can encourage them. I just think it's an important issue. I don't think that I've discovered anything very special, except in our own community, where the Elkanah thing for a long time has been that one set of parents is not enough for one set of kids, and a very real effort to invite other parents to accept some responsibility in raising our children, and vice versa. And all our children are teenagers, and some of our staff's kiddies have grown up with them, and it's really beautiful to find that our kids will often go to one of the other adults in the community to share something with them. And I would just as frequently find myself sharing with some of the kids that belong to other parents. And I think it's been that joint parenting thing that has been a very important aspect in our children's lives. And I like the idea of two or three couples getting together on a fairly regular cell group way, and inviting them to help them with their parenting, each couple to help the other couple with parenting, share the struggles, encourage those parents to plug in. It's been a terrific thing for our kids to find that there are other adults who have the same stance on an issue as their parents, but they've got a different way of putting it, you know, and a different way of getting it over, and the kids respond much better to it coming from someone else than us. And it's frequent for us, or was frequent for us, to say to some very good friends in the community, hey, sometime when you've got time, I'd like you just to spend some time with Warren, or spend some time with Daryl, and just at some appropriate time they'll plug in, and it all happens. So I think it's probably by dropping the barriers a bit, letting another family in, and letting them share your bringing up your children.
Earlier when your kids were younger, you shared with them, like, you established a, I don't know whether you call it a kid's night or a kid's hour, which made you think of
your own family. Yeah, some many years ago, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, we started a family night, which was one night a week we put aside for the family, and we cancelled everything every week for that one night. And that's a very important issue. If you ever do this, don't ever swap it around to fit into your program, because the value statement you're making to your kids with a family night is the most important part of the family night. When you say, Tuesday's our night, even if the Queen invites me to a dinner, then that's a value statement. And that's a very important value statement. So we had Tuesday night was our night for the family, and we spent that night together every week, regardless of what was on. And And that was a very important way of plugging into where the kids were at by playing with them and listening to them and so on. And if anybody did call on that night, unannounced, then they had two choices. One was to come and join us for the family night, and the other one was to go away and come back another day. And very often we had families or people arrive, join us for the family night, do exactly what the kids had designed for the night. The kids didn't mind that, and that was one way of modelling a family at work. And we had others start up family nights as a result of just happening to drop in on that particular night. So they were very important to us. The other important thing was moving our family we're not experts in families, but we just happened to have had four fairly easy kids to raise, I think. But one of the beaut things was moving our devotional family devotions from the tea table to the bedroom. We were the sort of couple who used to make our kids eat everything, you see. So you eat your cabbage, eat your pumpkin, eat your stewed apple, you know, and it would be Third World War every night. And then at the end of that, we'd pull out the Bible, you see. And it wasn't long before they'd equated the Bible with the cabbage, and they hated both. And so we decided that was a bad show. And apart from that, it was psychologically a very bad time to have devotion. Because there's only a limited time between tea time and bedtime, and there's a world of things to do between tea time and bedtime. So if you make the kids sit there for another 10 minutes, then there's another 10 minutes I can't do what I want to do. So we used to let them go from the tea table, do what they wanted. Then when they were ready for bed, we would sit on the bed, or individual beds as they got older, and we would talk with them and pray with them. And then beautiful. What does a little kid want to do most of all at bedtime? Yeah, have a cuddle. Keep the light on. Keep the light on as long as you can. So they ask profound theological questions and keep you going all night, you see. And that was the real connection point with our kids, was sitting on their beds at night, listening to them and praying with them. And we have one married now, but our next one down the line is 21. And when he comes home in a weekend, he would not let me go to bed without me sitting on the bed and talking to him. And that was what happened. That started when he was 2 or 3, you see. One of the things we learnt was that you should always interview the people who come into your house in a room out of which you don't have to tip your kids. Now, if you've only got a lounge room and that's where the kids play, then you've got to find somewhere else to talk to your people. Because the most hurtful thing for the kids is to set up a castle on Lego blocks in the lounge room. And Mrs. Higgins comes in for the 250th time with a depression problem, and they know that she's never going to get better. I mean, the kids know more better than you than that. They're realists, and yet they get kicked out of the lounge room, and Mrs. Higgins gets pride of place. I think the other thing is to control your time. I think if Mrs. Higgins comes, you don't have to see her straight away. She can have a cup of tea and wait for an hour while you finish tea. Or she can come back in a time more. I think you've got to take control. There's too many. My problem in the house next door to the chapel was when people came, I saw them.
I appreciate that. Mm. I agree. I think the I'm concerned about is where an unspoken, and maybe the people that aren't even coming on to the actual premises.
Their expectations.
They're all around all the time looking into the fishbowl.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, if you said fishbowl, I would run into glass houses I don't know much about. Yeah, that's right. The minister's family often lives in a fishbowl and people are watching. And it's not only when your house is next door to the church, is it? And my kids, we live 100 kilometres from Melbourne, and two of my boys were on a train in Melbourne one day where they'd been visiting Melbourne, and they'd bought a record, a non-Christian record, and they were sitting looking at it. We have a wide range of music in our house, and they were sitting, and a man got up from a seat to get out at a station, stopped at the seat and said, "You better not let your father see that record," and got out of the train. Well, look, they were ropeable. And they come home. They weren't angry at us, but they were just angry at this man who had the audacity to, you know, on the basis of whose kids they were, to tell them, you know, and the, they felt he had some sort of ownership over them. And so I think we taught them out of that. We sat down in a long talk about that. And if you ask any of my kids now if they're Graham Cann's children, they'll say, no, he's our father. And what we've tried to do is to get them to see that they have to stamp their individuality, and we'll support them in the individuality, even if sometimes it's a bit embarrassing. If you don't do that, you know what's going to happen? That in order to rebel against that lifestyle, that fishbowl lifestyle, they're going to rebel against your gods. But if you give them permission to move out of the fishbowl and protect them and defend them in that, even if their lifestyle is a little bit embarrassing up to a point, then they won't have to rebel against you and your God. But we've got to have a bit of courage about it. Iva and I are related. We're married to sisters. And they've grown up in Sydney, and their kids have grown up in Sydney. Our kids have grown up in Mitchell. And I know that we've sat quite red-faced sometimes as our Labour voting Christian socialist son has argued with his right-wing relatives about, you know, things. And we just sat there, we hope they don't think that's us, you know. But really, it's worth it, you know. It really is worth it, because they develop, they grow through that in time, and they get to a point where they see things their own way, and they've got their own faith to express their way. But you've got to let them out of the fishbowl. We often keep them in the fishbowl ourselves, because we are sensitive about what people see. We're finished, are we? We are sensitive about what people see, and then we keep saying to our kids, you must behave yourself, you must do this, and they'll rebel against that. Don't do that.
It's very hard to support in your age bracket.
Oh yes, it is, really. It takes a lot of time and involvement with your kids.
Thank you very much.
God bless you. Good. Good. Your Jeff. What are you into, Jeff?
I'm a minister as well.
Oh yeah, good. Where at? Oh, right. Baptist Church? Church of Christ. Oh, you're all part of this Church of Christ group. Yeah. You brought down a group from your church, I guess. Oh, good. What a terrific idea. We had a minister come to a marriage in Richmond recently with his wife and four couples from their church. And it was wonderful, because they went back and they started a monthly grow group, and next marriage in Richmond there were another four couples coming, and his aim is to get the whole church there, you know.
You mentioned marriage.
Yes, it is.
Oh. Can you get some tea with me? Something along the
line.
Evening meal or something like that. I'd love to yarn to you.
All right. Grab a spot and I'll sit with you, eh?
Terrific.
We're going to do that. The only one in Queensland I can think of is a guy called John and Judy. Come on. They were the leaders of Family Life Movement for a while. John. John. Well, while I'm trying to think of them, I've just thought of another couple in Queensland, Charles and Pat Nola.
Well, that'd be Mala. Lovely, Jeff.
Nola.
Just slip away for a weekend. Then
yeah.
What do you do with
now, they're
children,
both doctors of psychology, those two, and you can contact them at the university.
Brisbane.
What's Brisbane? That's St. Lucia?
Well,
Brisbane. Is there one called Brisbane University? Or Queensland? No, Queensland University. Yeah, it's one called Queensland. Yeah, well, there's that one.